This month at PostWrestlingCafe.com, go XL and you get live editions of Rewind to Raw, Rewind to Dynamite, and Rewind to SmackDown, featuring all the news of the day, your questions and answers, as well as feedback. PostWrestlingCafe.com, $6 gets you in the door.
Brandon Thurston from WrestleNomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Delivering on the returns, increasing our margins.
Ratings go down the toilet if I'm not here.
All I do is simply put the math in my favor.
We agree that Brandon and John do good work.
The reason is simple wrestling economics.
Told the Netflix numbers. I've been told the metrics a little bit, probably five different times. I still don't get it.
There were respectable wrestling journalists who needed answers.
Thank you very much, members of the media. I hope you all go to hell.
How about we pop a number right here, right now?
A whole part of the show, man.
And welcome, everybody, to Pollock and Thurston for January the 21st. On today's show, it's a couple weeks late, but the Christmas gift of the Netflix engagement report has dropped.
It's here.
The most anticipated Excel spreadsheet of the year provided by the world's largest streamer. What does this mean for WWE? We will find out.
What does
out.
It mean We're gonna... for WWE? We don't have a stinger for that.
That's a question
no one
that
cares.
Often...
No one cares about what it means for WWE.
Yeah, we need to... Need to keep everyone here on their toes. We're also going to be discussing the Netflix earnings report and TNA's launch on AMC, the rare episode of pro wrestling that even caught Brandon Thurston's attention last Thursday night.
I did watch. I'm here for our breakdown of Impact's debut on AMC. It was a show that happened and it took place and it aired on television. And that's the lead takeaway for me.
Well, we will get Brandon's thoughts on Hollywood Row and the utilization of Bully Ray on commentary and much more to come. And
reportedly not just the commentator, but yes.
And their audience. How did they do on AMC? But we will start with the Ring Boy lawsuit, because last Friday was an important date because the defendants had to file their answers to said suit. And we got specific answers from various defendants, including Vince and Linda McMahon, who are being represented separately, including for those that need a history lesson. Who is one of Linda McMahon's lawyers in this case?
Linda McMahon's, it appears, lead lawyer is Laura Brevetti, who is a former, I believe, K&L Gates lawyer and a former general counsel for WWE.
That is right. She was one of their representatives in the steroid distribution trial, then came to work for WWE for a time, and then... representing Linda in this specific case. So the stories might change, but the players stayed the same. But wait, Brandon, as we talk about this, these answers here, you wrote a story up at postwrestling.com. And one of the main takeaways here is that the John Does that have filed the case, they have obviously been anonymized, and the McMahons responded here to a request for them to continue to remain anonymous, and what is the position that they are taking? Maybe we can start there.
So I want to be careful and clear. All we have regarding the pseudonym issue, which is that apparently Vince and Linda are opposing their continued use of the John Doe pseudonyms as opposed to their real identities. We don't have anything but the plaintiff's account of a meet and confer. Apparently they met on December 18th, according to the plaintiffs, and the plaintiffs say that they couldn't come to an agreement about continuing to use the pseudonyms, which they agreed to earlier in this case. They say that Vince and Linda actually expressly oppose this, and WWE/TKO has taken no position. So we only have the plaintiff's account. You're talking about the answers that they did file. They didn't address that in the answers, nor would they be expected to. So one would expect that they're going to file an opposition. At least Vince and Linda will. Maybe WWE TKO won't. We did reach out to comment for them for this article, all the defendants, to ask them, you know, is this true what the plaintiffs are saying here? What is your position? What are the reasons for them? And they did not respond. So I would expect that within the next couple of weeks. I think I've put in here what I expect the date would be. They filed, the plaintiffs filed their filing motioning to maintain the pseudonyms on the 12th. I believe the defendant's due date for opposition filings would be on the 26th. So that is this next coming Monday. So we'll see if they file that and see what their arguments are. I suppose they may be arguing, this is just my speculation, but what they might be arguing is that without their real identities being known to the public, that might encumber their ability to do discovery, to find witnesses who may support their side of the story. If we don't know, you know, who these John Doe plaintiffs are, then the public can't know that, oh, I interacted with this person at this relevant time period, and I have something to say about this that may support the defendant's case. So that may be something that they're going for. There may be other issues or entirely different issues that they'll raise.
Yeah, and you've obviously brought this point up before, but this is not a case where the defendants don't know the identities.
Correct.
They know who these people are.
That's,
so in theory,
yes,
they could be conducting their case with the knowledge, and perhaps they feel there is some benefit to the public knowing who these people are, which is that's going to be a tough argument when you're talking about, you know, sexual abuse and re-traumatization, and a judge is obviously going to have to make a decision on that ruling, but they do know who the identities are.
Right. They've known since early on in this case, their names, and I believe even their addresses. And the plaintiffs have raised exactly that there's great concern that they would be re-traumatized if their names are known publicly. They explicitly note that there's a lot of wrestling media coverage of this. I think even our podcast is mentioned in a footnote. So the notion is that these people would be known irreversibly known, and there's even mentioning of a lot of people who are close to them do not even know that that this allegedly happened to them, the abuse. So that's what they're already asserting. And yes, since early on in this case, it's not as if you get sued by somebody and you don't get to know who's suing you when they use a pseudonym. These defendants have been informed who they are.
So it's the answers that were filed by Vince McMahon and Linda McMahon. There's a lot of kind
have
of
you
just
read them.
I have gone through them. Yes, there is a lot.
You have two monitors. You really need two monitors, because what an answer is it's you literally, the defendant literally goes through the plaintiff's
like line
complaint,
by line,
paragraph by paragraph, and you say I deny this, I deny this, I admit to this. It's usually something very narrow and basic. I don't have knowledge about that. Yeah.
If there is a particular interview or book or documentary,
yes,
with respect, they refer you to that item of media. I mean, they brought up the Donahue Show is cited in this.
Right.
David Bissonnette.
This complaint is virtually a history of the Ring Boy scandal, with a lot of references to media and different interviews and different books and different shoot interviews, etc.
Yeah. I guess the significant items in this, I mean, the defendants are obviously, like in the initial complaint, they list, you know, countless allegations in all of this. Linda's answer includes a recap that she was not even aware that there were minors on Mel Phillips' ring crew until 1992, which would have been when the first allegations came out in the San Diego Union Tribune and then subsequently in the New York Post, and really exploded in early 1992. That's Linda's claim, and that would stand to reason that Linda would be in complete denial of anything related to this 1988 firing and rehiring of Mel Phillips, which is also brought up in this. And that to me is like a very, very key event in all of this, was the circumstances behind Mel Phillips firing in 1988, and then the reporting of both Phil Mushnick and Dave Meltzer that they had calls with Vince McMahon, that he had rehired Mel Phillips in 88 on the provision that he steer clear of kids.
And which Mushnick has testified to in a deposition in 1993.
Yes. Mushnick testified to, like, that would, in theory,
we have denials of this from Vince and Linda. We have denial, because the lawsuit says that they have never denied that they brought Mel Phillips back, who is, by the way, the one who is alleged to have perpetrated all this abuse, almost all of it. The plaintiffs say that Vince and Linda have never denied that they brought back Mel Phillips with the instruction that he steer clear of kids, alluding to the notion that they were aware that he was a danger to children, but as long as you steer clear of children, okay, we'll bring you back. And then, according to this lawsuit, there are abuse allegations after that point. They deny that this happened. An answer is very basic. Yes, it goes through every single paragraph, but it's not like they're motivated to get into all sorts of detail. These are just sort of true false sort of answers here. So we don't know exactly what the detail of their defense would be as far as their denial of this specific issue, which has been, I think it's been one of the things that people point to the most when it comes to this issue, is that, yes, there's this rehiring in 88 before his eventual permanent firing in 1992, and you've got these abuse allegations that happen in the meantime as well. It's related, too, to why Linda... Only two of the plaintiffs have claims that will continue to be litigated against Linda, whereas with Vince and WWE, it's seven. Basically, the timeline there is that the judge determined that the claims of negligence, the claims that they would have knowledge of what Mel Phillips was doing, that only starts for Vince, I believe, around 1983, when you have this story of a security guard finding Mel Phillips allegedly abusing a boy in a car and brings Mel Phillips to Vince and makes him aware of what's happening. The clock starts there for negligence, for plausible negligence. Again, the judge has not ruled on any of the merits here, but has ruled that these are plausible enough to continue to be litigated. And then for Linda, I believe it starts around 1988, and that's why we only have two plaintiffs who are sticking to her to continue to be litigated.
Yeah, from Brandon's article, it reads here, Linda McMahon's answer states that she was unaware until 1992 that minors worked on Phillips' ring crew. So she is not stating she was not aware of abuse allegations. She's flat out stating she was not aware of minors working on the ring crew, period, which I have a hard time believing. Like, Linda's not on the road, but you would just think at some, like, there would be at least knowledge of this. But, I mean, that's... You would have to prove that, obviously. Linda is denying this. Both McMahons deny the plaintiff's claims that they never denied awareness of Phillips' purported interest in boys. The McMahons and WWE predecessor entity Titan Sports sued Phil Mushnick and the New York Post for defamation in 1993 for what Vince's answer says were, quote, defamatory and false statements by the columnist who wrote about the Ring Boy scandal in the early 90s. And that was a case that ended, and there was right. There was no obligation for Phil Mushnick to agree or state any wrongdoing or post a retraction. It was just like the case ended, and there was like no side was found to have. Well, Mushnick did not have to admit right. any wrongdoing.
As far as we know, there was no money that was changed hands as a result of this dismissal of this case. I think the defendants might raise that they were about, they were dealing with the indictment and the steroid trial that was on the horizon. So they dropped the case.
Also brought up is the denial that Mel Phillips was compensated anything when he cut ties with the company in 1992. All the defendants deny that Phillips was paid $840,000 upon separation from the WWF in 1992. Linda's answer specifically denies any payments to Phillips. The denial is counter to a detail raised publicly by Gerard Millett, a former WWF ring boy who defends Phillips and disbelieves the former ring announcer abused the plaintiffs, who has recounted that Phillips got a severance payment north of $800,000. So, again, this is not leaving any ambiguity here in terms of if the $840,000 was off. Linda's saying flat out there was no money given to Phillips. Right. And again, like we look at this from 2026 and you see a figure like that and you probably don't bat an eye. In 1992, like, that's a sizable amount of money for Titan Sports in 92. It's not going to break the company, but that's a lot more money than, what we're talking about now and the value of the financial value of some of these NDAs that Vince McMahon was behind over the last 20 years. But that's another aspect that is denied by the defendants.
And according to Gerard, he says that he saw the check himself, I believe, and he says that a lot of Mel Phillips' money was taken from him by the IRS, apparently, for not filing his taxes properly in the past. So, yeah.
It would be curious if there could be any kind of paper trail that would be attached to that, if all of that lined up as well, as you and I play detective here. And the lawsuit also references a 1999 suit brought on by former ring boy Scott Hopkins against Titan Sports and Phillips, in which Hopkins alleges he was abused by Phillips. Like many of the paragraphs, the defendants refer the court to the original materials without taking a specific position. However, Linda's answer asserts that she has no memory of the lawsuit, which reportedly resulted in a settlement between the plaintiff and the WWF. So Linda does not remember anything. Like, none of this happened, allegedly.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely a real lawsuit. We have pieces of it. I think I can show this here. Like, we do have the defendant's answer from the lawsuit. This lawsuit from originally filed in 1999 was litigated into 2001. It's a real lawsuit that definitely happened. We're noting
this is when Linda is like the number two executive at the company.
Yes.
But there was a lot going on during that time period. So, you know, the cases might have slipped through the cracks. And the rest here, just noting about Tom Cole, Linda acknowledges meeting with Tom Cole. They rehired him in 1992, and then he was fired 1 year later in 1993 after they believed that he was not meeting the conditions of his employment, which included attending school and working toward a degree. And there was a very up and down relationship that Tom Cole had with Linda McMahon. If you remember, like, they were kind of on the outs at times. Then when she was running for Senate at a period, Tom Cole had come out and like endorsed her. It was quite a like up and down relationship that Tom Cole had specifically to Linda McMahon over the years as well. And those are kind of the keynotes here. And the last bit here was just regarding the John Does and which ones the charges apply to, or the allegations apply to Linda McMahon, and which ones, there was one dropped, of course, of the John Doe, yes, who it dates back to the 70s, and because of the statute of limitations, he is not, it does not apply.
So not for statute of limitations. Of course, we have the law here that has removed all statute of limitations.
It predates their ownership
in Maryland. Like I was just talking about earlier, the clock is basically started for possible negligence around, I believe, 1983. So this one, I believe it's John Doe 7, who alleges that he was abused in the 70s, because his is the earliest of all, and his is before Vince McMahon allegedly becomes aware of Mel Phillips abusing a boy in the car. There's the judge determined, I believe this would be the right way to say it, that there isn't plausible negligence there, because Vince allegedly is you haven't alleged that he's aware of this yet.
If you're the purchasing manager at a manufacturing plant, you know having a trusted partner makes all the difference. That's why, hands down, you count on Grainger for auto reordering. With on-time restocks, your team will have the cut-resistant gloves they need at the start of their shift. And you can end your day knowing they've got safety well in hand. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello, Braden Harrington here from Up Next. You can catch us live every Tuesday here at Post Wrestling as we cover NXT. But if you search Poison Rana in your YouTube or podcast app or social media of choice, you can check out all the other wrestling content that we create, podcasts, and so much more. Visit PoisonRana.ca and keep it lit.
Any other takeaways from the answers that you went through? Linda seemed to be a little bit more specific in terms of like addressing several, but overall, like these were mandatory to be filed by Friday. Yes. And I mean, that's sort of like their position. Like, this is certainly not the, this is not the significant responses from the defendants. This is more so just acknowledging and giving kind of like a bare bones response to most, and a lot of denials or just outright referring to other articles.
Yeah, I would expect that by Monday or about then, the defense, at least Vince and Linda, it looks like WWE will not do something here. But Vince and Linda will presumably file oppositions if they're going to file anything opposing the continued use of pseudonyms. And other than that, I believe we're into the discovery phase here. And that would mean, I would think largely depositions. I don't know if there's going to be many records that can be recovered from the 1980s and so forth. But one would expect subpoenas to start appearing perhaps on the docket.
Are we ready to move on to the Netflix chapter of today's show?
I suppose we are.
Okay, we're going to go through the engagement report. We'll go through Netflix's earnings. Spoiler, they were high. And then we will ask the all-important question, what does this have to do with AEW? How does this affect AEW?
AEW will not be airing on Netflix, I heard.
It will not be on Netflix, that we know. No. We will get to all of that. No. But first, the engagement report. What is the Netflix engagement report? What are we about to dive into?
It is a twice-yearly report that Netflix blesses us with every 6 months. And so they just put out they do it coinciding with their quarterly report. So they just did, I believe, what was their annual report or whatever. They did their latest quarterly report, and it's time to release the second half of 2025 data, which is, you know, it's a big news release. It's some graphics. They highlight, wow, K-pop Demon Hunters is super popular. Stranger Things captivated audiences worldwide. Wednesday was, I believe, their number one show in terms of time. It goes on and on. You know, obviously Netflix is the leading streaming service by a pretty wide margin, right? But then they put at the bottom of this report very discreetly, download our full report for the second half of 2025 here. And if you click on that, you will download an Excel spreadsheet. And I've done some things with that Excel spreadsheet. Of course, because WWE is now a part of the Netflix universe, we have some extra information. And so we get information here that's, you know, beyond the top 10 that we get. It's a little, there's some caveats that we'll have to go through because this is an entire six-month window. The Tudum chart is a seven-day window for Raw. But I did put together a few charts here that we can look at that will be meaningful here. So I think one of the most interesting things is we finally get some premium live event data to look at. And remember, so what we're looking at here, I broke out, right? Like we have the first 6 months of WWE existing on Netflix from January to June, and now we have July to December to stack on top of it for the previous PLEs. My strongest takeaway here is that of this six-month period, July to December, the PLE that got the most global views on Netflix during this period is WrestlePalooza with 1.9 million global views. Remember, this doesn't include US. This is just wherever it's streaming internationally, which is, I think, in most regions. More than Survivor Series, which was 1.8 million. More than either individual day of SummerSlam, 1.7 for Sunday, 1.5 for Saturday. WrestlePalooza was a big hit, I guess. Any inferences to make from that?
Well, it's your natural thought would be, well, look at how much promotion they put into WrestlePalooza. But I would argue all of that promotion, though, was geared toward ESPN viewers.
Was the promotion happening internationally?
Exactly. That's right. What my argument would be is I would expect if we were to look at the ESPN stats, I could rationalize WrestlePalooza outperforming because there is no show, including Survivor Series, that came close to the promotion WrestlePalooza received. But that I don't think, unless you want to argue that, Brock Lesnar's return meant something, AJ Lee's return meant something. But the fact that we're looking at these numbers, and again, this does not include the US, but it does give you a sense Netflix, part of the whole Netflix deal was when they first sat down, they said, hey, wait till all of your global rights come up for grabs because we don't want to just go piecemeal. We want the whole global pie of WWE because they saw this as a growth play for Netflix. So these numbers are very important, even taking the US out of it. To me, SummerSlam would be very disappointing in comparison. This was a two-night show. It's, to me, at this point, they put as much into SummerSlam as they do the Rumble and maybe even more. This is, you watch Unreal. It's WrestleMania ends and SummerSlam's our focus. It's our next biggest event. And, you know, this had Cena, this had all of your big stars that they had built up. And it, to me, was, you know, this, we're looking at like the first night of SummerSlam that barely outdid Clash in Paris several weeks later, and was, the second night of SummerSlam that has Cena and Cody on top. It was lower than Survivor Series. It was lower than WrestlePalooza. It was, you know, right in the middle of things. So, and
I look at this and I'm hesitant to think that a significant number of fans are really going to extreme measures to watch WWE on Netflix. But I look at this, but combined with, you know, WrestlePalooza, it's 1.9, which is bigger than Survivor Series, bigger than either individual day of SummerSlam. And then if you look at the, you know, Crown Jewel in Perth, October 11th, is that was obviously in Perth, but so it aired at what time of day? Early in the morning-ish?
Yeah, it would have been an early morning start time, as I recall.
If we comp that to Night of Champions in the prior period, which was in Saudi Arabia and probably aired at a similar time, it's tough because that's right near the border of where these two reports come out. But if even you stack everything on top of it, I guess it did, you know, you could say maybe it would have done if it was measured evenly, like the rest of these were 1.2. This does 1.4. Crown Jewel Perth Survivor Series does better than either individual day of SummerSlam. I looked at this and I could not help but wonder if the ESPN deal has not driven more U.S. customers to get a VPN, to go to NordVPN.com/postwrestling and circumvent, you know, the $30 price point.
I mean, I think that would certainly be the case. And we'd be talking about the WrestlePalooza, Crown Jewel Perth, and Survivor Series of the ESPN shows. That you're right. Like, there was a sizable amount of people that did not get the ability to authenticate with their ESPN subscription that would have had to pay $30 after a decade of spending under $12 to stream all of the library, get all of the PLEs.
It's half the country who has cable, and then you have the other entire half of the, right? Like, there's, what, 60 million cable households? There's 120, 130 million households. So, I don't know, a quarter of the country was able to authenticate. The other three quarters, now, you know, they had to do something else.
There's also, I think it would be safe to say that if we were to get the full picture of the U.S. numbers, I would imagine we would still be looking at, like, this is probably indicative of the same level of interest the U.S. would have. Like, I imagine this would only, I still think if we added on the U.S. numbers, WrestlePalooza would probably be at the top here. Maybe Survivor Series is neck and neck with it, or even slightly above. But certainly Evolution was one that, at least right on these international numbers, looks like it greatly underperformed. And this was the discussion about the original Evolution in 2018, that, you know, it was a feel-good show. There was a lot of positivity toward the event, but they did not bring that show back. And this one, like, let's remember that weekend. This is the day after both All in Texas and an NXT show and a Saturday night's main event. And this was a criticism, right, that Evolution was getting stacked onto this weekend as sort of just, let's just completely elbow out AEW by stacking three WWE shows in 2 days. But certainly Evolution, it feels like there was, at best, you can argue there was fatigue after Saturday, but also you have to look at it like how much interest there was in Evolution. And this shows you, like, this is dramatically below any of the other PLEs.
I'm searching to find it. I'm seeming to remember Paul Levesque maybe being asked whether there would be future Evolution or women's only shows in the future. And he gave a response that made you think that maybe not. And you know, I'm sure he was being told what the numbers were that night.
Yeah, I mean, it's one that, like, this does not stand out doesn't stand out in a positive way in comparison. Do you read anything into just, like, we know that the WWE archives are not going to be doing gigantic numbers, but when we're looking back, like, this is just a 6-month window that it wouldn't, and this will certainly apply to the TV shows that we can go through too. Like, the ability of WWE having, like, a rewatch factor of people that maybe later in the year are going back to watch WrestleMania or the Royal Rumble. Like, the Rumble's got, like, a, a little bit of a chunk here, because we can see what people watched for the last half of the year going back here. But this is like, it's pretty much people are watching these live the night of, and they've got about a 48 hour window or so that I think people are engaged in these. And you're talking about a very, very small subset that might go back and watch a WWE pay-per-view.
Yeah, I mean, we have, is that maybe what's on the next slide, is we have a breakdown of, you know, what's the, I broke these out. This is all my manual, by the way. This is not in the Netflix report. This is the data, the spreadsheet is, and I've made some charts and tables.
This is their worst nightmare, color-coded charts of WWE breakdown.
Yeah, so what I did here is I took this July to December period, and I said, all right, I may or may not have missed some things, but I think I got almost all of it, if not all of it. And I broke them down into various categories: Raw, SmackDown, the PLEs that took place in this 6-month period, WWE Unreal, which we should talk about, NXT, including the NXT PLEs, and then the past PLEs, which includes things that took place in the first half of the year and everything else that's in their back archive. And it accounts for those past PLEs account for 2% of the hours viewed. So I don't know. It's something. It's about what I would expect. I'm not like surprised by it, and I think, you know, as people have more and more entertainment options, I think wrestling, the replay value of wrestling gets diminished.
Yeah, and we might get a clearer picture of this when the next engagement report comes out, because for these next 6 months, we'll get the U.S. value of these past PLEs that they've now added to Netflix as well, but. Like, yes, the hours viewed will be up, but I still don't see it making up any. Like, what is the value of this library? To me, it's a nice add-on if you're a WWE fan that you have these at your disposal. But, like, you're not getting any outside fans that are going to just be sampling through Netflix and saying, hey, let's pop on WrestleMania 7. And even your wrestling fans that are signing up specifically for Raw and WWE Unreal, it's a really tiny percentage that are going to fall into that category. So they might be nice to have, but I mean, when we're talking about like the NXT PLEs, like the NXT library, like I just don't know where the interest is going to be of like a very, very small audience that is interested in these.
So breaking this down into categories, obviously Raw is airing in the US, so that's going to, you know, be well ahead of everybody else. That's accounting for 59% of the W watch time on Netflix. But after that, you got SmackDown with 13, and just about even with SmackDown are the PLEs. I guess that makes sense. I mean, it tells you that the PLEs are driving a large audience, and we do see that when they're all ranked together, right? Like, the PLEs are driving a larger audience individually than individual episodes of SmackDown are. SmackDown just has more volume, more episodes, more hours of content, and so they end up being even with the PLEs. And then WWE Unreal, well ahead of NXT, you got, you know, WWE Unreal accounting for 9% of the W watch time that I've got here, compared to NXT, including its NXT PLEs, 3%. So, I mean, I would not have predicted Unreal doing as big numbers as it is. So I think that's got to be considered a success.
I think so. You know, this like Raw and Unreal are the only examples where we do have the U.S. audience accounted for. But it tells me, like, Unreal is a sizably more valuable.
Oh, true. That is a U.S. audience as well.
Yeah, I mean, but regardless, I still feel like if you're arguing, like, what is more valuable, 5 episodes of WWE Unreal versus decades of past pay-per-views, it's the 5 episodes of Unreal that are way more enticing to an audience than past events. So,
and
yeah,
they're going to do a third season, right? So that all aligns, that they're bringing it back. That indicates that they're happy with this to do a third season of it.
I found this interesting. So I went through all of the Raw numbers, and
did you?
They range. So this, I guess the clock would start ticking like the June 30th Raw. It falls on obviously a Monday. So that's kind of gives you the, like, that was the bottom end here of 1.5 million views of this 6-month period. And it goes as high as 3.5 million views for the November 17th Raw, which was seen as last Raw at Madison Square Garden. However, if we're going to look at this difference, okay, June 30th, 1.5 million views. June 23rd, 1 week before, 400,000 views for Raw. So that tells me like 90% of the viewing is all happening June 23rd or the day after. And it's a like no one's going back to watch old Raws. And I would just be curious if they look at this in terms of like sports where it's relevant for that day and primarily live viewing, or did they go into this with the thought that this is, it's kind of sport, but it's also like, this is closer to like scripted drama that is going to have more of these episodes are going to have longer legs to them, that there would be some rewatch value to them. And
I would think the DVR data, which certainly WWE has access to, I don't know if Netflix has access to Nielsen data because they're not a Nielsen customer, but I'm sure they could get it one way or another. I would think that the DVR data would be very informative to that, and I think this aligns with what we've seen from the DVR lift data for wrestling over the years, is that it's a 10 to 20% lift. Maybe you have 80 to 90% of the viewing is happening live in the same day, and I think they would be mistaken to expect more than that.
SmackDown, I mean, it doesn't include the US, so we're looking at pretty much a range of like 1 million to 1.3 million views per episode of SmackDown is pretty much there are some that go below the million threshold where they're just rounding these off. There's actually some that go as low as 700,000. NXT is exceptionally like low. Again, this does not include the US, but like the most watched episode of NXT was their homecoming episode in September that had 300,000 views. And like its PLEs are even lower than that. And most of the NXT episodes were in the range of 100 to 200,000 views, which again, they just round these off. So they're various ranges here that we have.
Yes. The other thing that I prepared here is that it's all very simple. We have a linear regression model that allows us to, and now as people know, as people, follow the Raw numbers every week. And by the way, we just got a new top 10 chart yesterday that has no Raw number on it. Raw did not make the top 10. It looks like Stranger Things did a huge week again. I think actually number 10 is something like 2.4, 2.5 million. So it does suggest that Raw did a lower number than usual. Anyway, we've got in this 6 month period from July to December, there were 5 instances where Raw did not make the global top 10. But we do have data in this spreadsheet for all the episodes of Raw, but it's for this 6 month period from July 1st to December 31st. So there's some extra delayed viewing on this that those episodes get to benefit from that the other episodes that do make the top 10 don't get to benefit from. In any case, I did a linear regression and tried to predict what those numbers that are unknown for the 7 day window would be. And I determined that they kind of do what you would expect them to do. They did in the mid, 2000 range, a few hundred thousand below 3 million. And it tells us that, these episodes in December maybe did around 2.6, maybe did around 2.7. But it does suggest that this December 29th episode did around 2.1 million. And as you can see, the strength of this model, it's sometimes it's right on and sometimes it's off by 100,000. But it does seem to be pretty close.
Were you frustrated at all that Raw was not labeled WWE Raw, as opposed to the other WWE program?
I mean, data cleaning is always a challenge, but they do make it easy enough because they put a colon after Raw, so you can just do a search for Raw colon. Yeah. These are issues that one deals with on a daily basis, trying to find the correct string to identify the information that you're after.
Yeah, when they came up with the name for Eddie Murphy's comedy special, it was specifically to confuse you.
Yes, I noticed that Eddie Murphy Raw is in there.
Anything
he's like stand-up thing from like what the 70s or the 80s?
Oh, is it an old comedy special? I just recently watched.
Yes, of course.
I just watched the documentary on Eddie Murphy. It was really good, actually.
Yes,
I think that was on
1987 is when Eddie Murphy Raw came out.
Awesome. Well, Is there anything just in conclusion here of you look at in terms of like Raw, we do get a complete viewing with the U.S. audience. Do you feel like these are, you know, just in comparison, like this is unlike a lot of Netflix releases, like they are getting a new episode of Raw every week, which makes it pretty unique for Netflix. There is no other programming that is producing a new, pretty much always live episode every single week, and kind of goes against the event model that Netflix has applied to other sports or adjacent sports that it's attached
eventizing to. I think that's what they call that. Oh, I don't know. I think this deal has been decent for both parties, probably, right? I think, you know, Netflix has been very successful, and they're investing in more content that gets wrestling fans to maintain their subscriptions year round when people are, you know, jumping in and out to watch this and that series. If you're going to watch Raw most of the time, if you've got a podcast where you've got to review Raw, and Lord knows there's many of them, then you've got to keep Netflix year round. So I think it's going well enough. And based on what the debut episode did and what these subsequent episodes have done, it seems to be doing viewership that's quite comparable to what it was doing on USA Network. Unless you think they're cooking these books here, it is first party data, and anything is possible. But it seems like their viewership is on par. If you take these numbers at face value, it's on par with what Raw was doing on USA Network at the end. So I think it's been doing all right. Now, this hasn't resulted in an uptick in other streams of business, I think, because of this. I think they're doing, you know, it's an even move in terms of reach.
And now, just so everyone is clear, when does the HBO Max engagement report drop?
Never. That'll never be dropping.
What about the ESPN?
Unless HBO Max just goes away and all of that content gets combined into Netflix, and then it becomes part of this report, which I don't see happening.
Is this an argument in favor of Netflix taking over the world?
Yeah. The more that we can get streaming data that's actually available and published in an Excel spreadsheet, let's do it.
Maybe that should be Netflix's argument that the Ellisons cannot match. We will disclose all of our data points on a biannual basis.
I would be in favor of that.
Let's go to the Netflix earnings. We won't spend too much time on this, but they did hold their fourth quarter year-end earnings on Tuesday night, and they did surpass their revenue expectations, reporting $12.1 billion for the quarter, and citing the success of Stranger Things and the NFL Christmas Day shows in terms of its viewership growth, which it does cite Nielsen, stating they had a 10% viewership growth in this quarter. And of course, the big news this week is that they are moving forward now with an all-cash purchase offer of WBD for $82.7 billion or $27.75 per share. They also updated that they have surpassed 325 million paid subscribers, which is up from 300 million a year ago. And their revenue they are forecasting for 2026 is between 50.7 and 51.7 billion. And only Netflix could this be disappointing to the street that were expecting a little more revenue projection. And Netflix's stock did fall around 4% after the earnings. And since the announcement that they were going after WBD, this stock has fallen 16% since the beginning of December. This has not been met well with this this pursuit of WBD. So, yes, it's Reuters noted that in its note to investors, Netflix said the Warner Brothers acquisition will provide it with an even broader and higher quality selection of movies and shows for its subscribers, while it will be able to offer more personalized, flexible subscription offers with the addition, not the elimination, of HBO Max.
Yeah, I think I've said this before. I don't think you're going to get you're not going to get all that content combined in, and it's just going to be a tab that's included with your same price point Netflix. If these two streaming services get combined, it'll be bundled, and you'll be paying maybe you get a slight discount for having both of them. I think there are bundles where you can get in the U.S. at least, where you can get both HBO Max and Netflix together, maybe with some other things. But yes, this will probably not result in a great deal for the consumer. What does this mean for AEW?
That is a question on everyone's mind. And that was the question that Tony Maglio of The Wrap attempted to answer on Tuesday night with an article that dropped confirming that AEW will not air on Netflix. Not going to Netflix in Warner Brothers' deal. So, Ricochet, is this a... Who's he delivering this clothesline to?
Zack Sabre Jr.
Oh, it's Zack Sabre Jr. Wow, okay, that's a... And they even cite Zack Sabre Jr. here. So,
Ricochet of AEW attacks Zack Sabre Jr. during the New Japan Pro Wrestling Wrestle Dynasty at Tokyo Dome on January 5th, 2025.
Okay. Yeah. Just interesting photo selection here. So this article basically is information that comes from a combination of Tony Maglio's sourcing and a 519 page SEC document. Some light reading if you can get your hands on it.
And anybody can get their hands on it. It's right here. It's on Netflix. It's on, I think it's on WBD's IR site, and I'm sure it's in the SEC.gov. Records as well. 517 pages. Is that what he said it was? 519. I don't know what document he's got, but mine is 517.
Oh, what are the missing two pages? I mean, like this could be a scandal. So in the article, we'll read some of it here. Netflix and Warner Brothers Discovery jointly filed a 519 or 517 page proxy statement with the latest update to their Hollywood shaking deal. It goes on to state that buried in the lengthy filing, everything is buried, were some random nuggets about the landing spot for certain secondary WBD rights, like the destination for Turner Classic Movies. Sports rights will be especially mobile, and you can double that generalization for international markets. Though neither the phrase All Elite Wrestling nor the acronym AEW appeared once in the proxy, page 53 foretold the future for the WWE competitor. Really, it was the absence of the words and letters that informed some of this reporting. Following the close of the Netflix WBD deal, All Elite Wrestling rights will ostensibly remain with Discovery, aka the Global Linear Networks Company, which has a more crass name for those that just use the lingo. Though the league's weekly series and premium live events are expected to continue streaming on HBO Max throughout the remainder of AEW's current contract, Dynamite airs on TBS, Collision on TNT, both stream on HBO Max. That's not necessarily unexpected, but it is confirmation. The AEW TV deal is tied to the basic cable channels at the end and expire at the end of 2027 or 2028, depending on what becomes of the contract's fourth year option. At that time, AEW programming is likely to leave HBO Max and join the upcoming Turner Sports streaming app. Of course, 2 or 3 years is an eternity in the current media landscape, and so much can change within that time frame. There's even the possibility of a non-exclusive arrangement in which both HBO Max and Turner Sports stream AEW events. Perhaps the former gets the PLEs and later the episodic TV shows. So multiple outcomes that could come out of this, including Netflix not getting Warner Brothers Discovery, that we should caveat. This is not a done deal yet.
Right. It seems like the likeliest outcome at this point, yes. I will mention that Tony Maglio did ask me some questions ahead of this to just background information on AEW. So if you want to blame someone for the notion that WBD has an ownership stake in AEW being in here, you might be able to blame me for that. I do believe that, and Tony Khan has been asked specifically about it at least two times over the last couple of years. And
Tony Khan has never denied this, but he has done all but danced around confirmation of this, that when he has been asked about this, he has stated he has 100% creative
voting power. All the voting power, which means perhaps WBD has non-voting stock.
Yes. He has never outright denied that WBD has some type of stake in the company. And
this is apparently just presumed to be a scandalous notion for people who are defending AEW. But I think there's nothing scandalous about it, that WBD may own. It would have to be less than 10%, because in federal lawsuits that AEW has been involved in, they would have to file a corporate disclosure if there's some publicly traded company that owns 10% or more of your company, you have to disclose that. So if they own something, which I believe they do, they own less than 10% of it. There's that. What else is in here? I mean, it's not a surprise to anybody so what we should point out here, right, is that there's what Netflix is buying is only the stuff on the right for people watching in video. They are buying HBO and HBO Max, Warner Brothers Studios, and some international rights. So what's mentioned in this article is he's referencing this right here, where WBD has some Italy international WWE rights. So Netflix, as they acquire the WBD streaming and studios portion of this business, would acquire those Italy international rights. I wonder if they would just put those people over on Netflix. Who knows? But yes, the HBO and HBO Max is part of what Netflix is acquiring. TBS and TNT are not currently. This other portion of the WBD business, which Netflix is not buying, will become its own separate publicly traded company. And that presumably would mean that AEW's rights, I mean, the main part of it, the AEW deal, I'm sorry, it's not the HBO Max part, it's the TNT and TBS part, where certainly the vast majority of the audience is still watching. And those rights will continue to be with TBS and TNT. I think it is a question, you know, if and when this deal gets completed, if HBO Max continues to offer the pay-per-views for AEW, the PLEs too. He called AEW pay-per-views PLEs, which is there may be some tickets handed out for that.
The MMA world is also adopting that term now for the UFC events as well.
I guess. Yeah,
UFC is trying to push numbered events as the nomenclature.
No, they've kind of always been. Yeah. What was I going to say? I forgot. I think it is a question whether HBO Max continues to be a pay-per-view carrier throughout the remainder of the deal, which let's think about when the deal ends for AEW. This current term ends at the end of 2027, or if WBD picks up the option, whoever is holding these rights at the end, could pick up the option and extend it to the end of 2028. The prior deal had an option in it too, and they did extend it. So by 2028, I think it's a question of whether Dynamite and Collision continue to simulcast on HBO Max throughout the lifetime of this deal. Although what Tony Maglio is saying here is that they probably will.
Yeah, I mean, it's one where I think the inference here that a lot of takes that come out of this article are, or at least when this sale first got announced, was, okay, Netflix is going to buy this company and they're going to boot AEW out of the wrestling industry. Is that going to happen, Brandon?
I don't know, but I think what's really interesting also in here is where he says, though unconfirmed, as he set it up with something, should Netflix integrate HBO Max into its own service, it may not even be able to carry AEW programming. I suppose if you imagine maybe it's just a tab or maybe it's combined completely, they may not be able to. Why would they not be able to? The Hollywood Reporter goes on. Though unconfirmed, it is believed WWE's parent company, TKO Incorporated, a non-compete clause in its deal with Netflix, a relic of the old days, a non-compete clause in their TV contracts that would, I mean, as I infer here, that would exclude at least other wrestling programming, though unconfirmed.
Now, is that
the case? This was an issue. I don't know. That was an issue raised in the MLW lawsuit. And remember when MLW made a deal with Reels in the midst of their antitrust lawsuit against WWE. Mm-hmm. MLW was airing on Reels, which was also simulcasting on Peacock. But when Reels was airing MLW on Peacock, it was blacked out. Because according to MLW, I think they were alleging that there was an exclusivity clause as part of WWE's deal with NBCU or whatever it was. I mean, this continues to raise antitrust questions. And if WWE has non-competes or exclusivity clauses in venues, I think that too. There's nothing on its own illegal about that. And no, the Department of Justice is probably not going to investigate TKO or WWE for this, but it does raise evidence that one could used to make a civil lawsuit, a civil case against WWE, if AEW ever wanted to sue WWE for antitrust.
And it's worth noting that, I mean, if Paramount were to come back and somehow enter the driver's seat of these of this attempt, they would be going for all of this. They would be trying to acquire everything.
They would be getting all of it. Yeah.
So there
including
is
the TNT and TBS.
Yes, but that all remains to be seen. Netflix is, you know, the favored acquirer of WBD's studio and streaming side, but this is going to be obviously a very major story, but obviously this does have a trickle-down effect to how it will impact AEW, because in a roundabout way, everything affects AEW in some way, shape, or form.
I mean, if there's a universe, you know, if in 2028, AEW is not able to renew its deal and stay on TNT and TBS, and they get a lesser platform, I mean, I don't know what Tony Khan's willing to do, but I think there would be a strong case for an antitrust lawsuit if there's exclusivity clauses that are closing them out. If you think through discovery, you can obtain evidence that they actively took steps to close you out of a media deal. Which, does that sound plausible to you that they would or that they have?
Would that cost TKO more than $20 million to settle?
I think that might cost more than the $20 million they spent to settle a lawsuit with MLW. And hey, look, you've got all this track record that probably it doesn't decide the case, but it's a track record worth mentioning in terms of you've been in litigation with fighters for over 10 years about antitrust. Okay, but that's UFC. Okay, but and MLW did not prove their case. They didn't get that far, but they did overcome a motion to dismiss.
Hello. Braden Harrington here from Up Next. You can catch us live every Tuesday here at Post Wrestling as we cover NXT. But if you search Poison Rana in your YouTube or podcast app or social media of choice, you can check out all the other wrestling content that we create, podcasts, and so much more. Visit PoisonRana.ca and keep it lit.
Well, that whole article can be found at The Wrap. .com with Tony Maglio going through the possible outcomes here.
The Hollywood Reporter. He's not with The Wrap anymore.
Oh my gosh. He used to be at The Wrap. Now he's at The Hollywood Reporter. I can't keep these LinkedIns going in my head. That's why I brought him here to go through all of this. TNA debuted last week on AMC. People might have heard. This was just a... seems like everyone in the wrestling world sat down Thursday night at 9 p.m. Eastern time, the new start time for Thursday Night Impact, and... flipped on AMC AMC Plus, where you could you could stream the show, and we got the most anticipated numbers of the new year.
These numbers do not include AMC Plus, okay?
That's right. Their streaming numbers could usurp SmackDown, I'm sure, possibly. But the debut episode on cable did 173,000 viewers and a 0.04 in the 18 to 49 demographic. The Torch was the first to report these numbers. And just going back, I mean, it's been 2 years since we got any kind of regular Impact data. But just looking at the award-winning, much-in-demand WrestleNomics viewership spreadsheet. In the month of December 2023, the show averaged 83,000 viewers and a big 0.01 in the 18 to 49 demo on Access TV. So that is a lifetime and a half ago in terms of cable homes and such, but that's the last kind of range of numbers we have for Impact. So this is a big jump, though. AMC is in probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 60 million homes. This is a big jump up from Access TV and the amount of the country that it had, quote unquote, access to. This was an episode that was largely panned by anyone with their senses in order. And it was a live episode as well. This had AJ Styles advertised. They had a championship match and title change on the show. And they will come back tomorrow night with another live episode of Impact. But yeah, there was a lot to discuss from this AMC premiere and at least the week one performance that you would think, if tradition holds up, is going to be the high point of the AMC era.
I cannot believe how negative people were about this. how miserable their lives must be. And they all forgot, too, that they're not allowed to, maybe you're allowed to be positive about it, but you're not allowed to critique wrestling.
No.
Unless you've been in the ring, but that would include me. So unless you're not allowed to critique anybody who outranks you, I think is the lesson here.
Yeah. Remember the old, argument, that, I think it was, that Paul Levesque had about OVW was that, these guys never headlined WrestleMania.
Right.
So right. there was always a higher bar, you know, if you've hired, I mean, who can critique wrestling? I think it's 10 people that are allowed to critique wrestling.
That's why if a surgeon ever makes a mistake in surgery with me, I would never critique him for that. I would say, you know what? Who am I to say? Maybe you did amputate the wrong arm.
Yeah. Like quite honestly, I mean, when you go out there, I mean, just don't make noise at an arena, okay? They're not performing for you, okay? They're performing for four people in the back.
That's why they're chanting AMC.
That's it. That's it. And Bioflux.
this number will probably be lower. And I feel very bad about misreading the programming insider chart and getting the number wrong at first. I was my office chair was not safe yesterday evening. But this is the correct number thanks to PW Torch. 173,000 0.04 in the demo. I mean, as debuts go, and you even had me tuning in, I would think it's going to be down from here, just as what the SmackDown debut on Fox, the Raw debut on Netflix, the Dynamite debut on TNT, they're all drastically down from the heavily hyped, heavily promoted debut. So I think it's going to be down from here.
You're not coming back for the outcome of Feast or Fired? Someone's going to be fired tomorrow night.
I don't know if I can endure another episode of this, at least not a week later. So I think it'll be down from here. I mean, this again, like you said, the last we knew on Access TV, a lot of their episodes were under 100,000. So compared to that, this is a lot better than that. I mean, what were they doing on Access TV, you know, a few weeks ago? I don't know. Probably way under this. And they may still end up a little bit, at least a little bit above whatever you think they were doing on Access. Because I don't think even Nielsen is measuring Access.
Yeah, like that. We have no comp to where Impact was as a baseline going into this AMC era, but we're at least going to get we're going to get a range now of, you know, the early portions and what they can keep up. And, you know, this also occurred 2 days before a pay-per-view. I don't even know if we will hear a number for Genesis. I mean, you can read into this whatever you would like, but they have made all these announced dates for the next couple of months. And outside of tomorrow night, there are no more live episodes planned. Like, it would seem like they're not, like, whatever the value of this deal is, we don't know what the value is. But to me, it would not suggest that they are aggressively going towards any kind of live or even like once a month live format. I'm sure there will be, they have said they will do live episodes, but it seems like they are going to largely maintain the old taping schedule that they were doing on Access here. And the goal of this is going to be, like, you have in theory a more eyes on your product on Thursdays, but how much is that going to translate to people spending money on the product, whether it be attendance, which has been certainly on the uptick over the last year, or to pay-per-view? Because I don't know if this, I think we can safely say, like, this deal alone is probably not going to be a game changer for TNA from a financial standpoint. I mean, even at the high end of what Carlos Silva was estimating they wanted of $10 million, like, extract that over 52 weeks. This is not going to be something that is going to, like, gigantically turn the fortunes of this company around. It's a positive, but it is, to me, not indicative of, you know, this this giant shift for the company financially.
Did you feel that the ad load was heavier than a normal program, a normal wrestling program?
It was, like, I watched it on the Rogers Sportsnet feed here in, or on Sportsnet 360 here in Canada, and going through, there were no commercial breaks that were under 3.5 minutes, and there were ones that approached 5 minutes in length. Like, that is significantly more than ad breaks.
I guess,
or
I
other
go back in time
wrestling now. Programming.
I did watch it live. I mean, I don't have an opinion about whether it felt like more or less. I mean, if there were more, it I guess that suggests that this is more of an ad revenue share, because more ads means more revenue to generate, I guess. But no, we don't have any idea. I don't have any idea what this deal consists of in terms of compensation to TNA. I can only infer that unless there was another bidder who was really pursuing this, like maybe CW, that I don't know that it would be more than an ad revenue share or something like that, because TNA is so benefited alone by the platform. It's a big step up from Access TV to AMC.
So week two is it going to be a, did you sign up for an AMC Plus trial, or did you?
No, it's part of YouTube TV.
Okay. So
I do get it.
You do have the option. So if you should choose to,
can I authenticate into AMC Plus with my YouTube TV credentials?
I have no idea.
Is that what you're telling me?
You're asking the wrong person. I know you can get a free trial of AMC Plus. That's about the extent of my knowledge of all the American packages that are at your disposal. We've also got UFC that begins its Paramount era this coming Saturday with UFC 324. The night before, it's the first official Zuffa boxing card that's taking place at the Meta Apex. So welcome to Zuffa Boxing inside of a warehouse. And today, actually, they are there's movement on the TKO bill at the house level. So we should have a story on that later today from Jack Wannan, who is following that story. But I just want to ask you a broad question, just given your own observations, how this is applied to wrestling. Like, do you expect there to be a big gain here, eliminating the pay-per-view price for the U.S.? This is going from an $80 product every month to now you get a Paramount Plus subscription and you get all of these numbered events. Like, in theory, UFC is both eliminating its paywall and it is getting $1.1 billion per year. It seems like UFC is in a pretty much a win-win position. Paramount, on the other hand, they have to make sense of this deal, which may be impossible to make this back, but it was a very aggressive move by Paramount. And for UFC, they're not just bringing down the paywall. They're also moving the start time up an hour to 9 p.m. Eastern time, which is a godsend for the East Coast viewership.
I wonder, so there's two tiers of Paramount Plus, $8.99 and $13.99. It doesn't say that one has UFC and does. Oh, it does say. Oh, it does. Oh, okay. Catch NFL on CBS, UFC, and UCL, whatever that is. So maybe it is on the lower price point as well with ads. This is not the biggest streaming service in the world, but it is. Maybe it's on the level of Peacock, and I think there was an additive effect for WWE from moving from W Network to Peacock. And that's not even moving from pay-per-view, which this is. I think it will be a downstream benefit. You'll have probably their biggest audiences for those number of pay-per-views ever, right? Because they've never not been on pay-per-view.
Yeah, like these numbered events, like they will never be as viewed as probably what we're going to see over the next year. It just is. It's a major, major savings for the audience, which is not typically how these deals work. It's kind of the opposite of WWE fans in the U.S. SmackDown, the Winter Olympics are beginning, and they will be moving to Sci-Fi for 2 weeks on February 13th and 20th. And I had an out-of-body experience this past week, Brandon, because I reached out to the USA Network, and I reached out to Sci-Fi, and all of them got back to me.
Wow.
And they all confirmed this to me. And I was like, wow, I asked a question, and I got an answer. This is mind-blowing. What is this?
Wrestling partners are great at that. Wrestling companies not so great at getting back to you, but wrestling TV partners and just about any partner, there's a good chance that they'll respond to you.
Yeah, and they even said if you have any more questions. Like, I was like, what's going on here? Is this a trap? I don't understand this. This was so foreign to me. But yes, they will be staying in the 3-hour format for these 2 weeks, February 13th.
Oh, good.
And relieved. 20th. Yeah, I was very worried that I would lose out on my SmackDown viewing by an hour for either of these weeks, but probably will be the least watched SmackDowns of the year, one would surmise. And then they return to USA February 20th.
Remember they did Raw did real well on Sci-Fi for the last Olympics.
It did hold up, and maybe there will be a an effect here on SmackDown. Maybe this.
I mean, that was a talking point for Nick Khan about how easy their audience transfers to a new network.
And finally, let's talk about some viewership figures before we get out of here. We will start off with Raw from last week that Brandon already mentioned did not rank in the global top 10. The cutoff was 2.5 million views. That was for the number 10 spot, but it did rank number 6 in the US and 8th in Canada. But the big story is it did return to the top 10 in Bolivia, along with the UK and Trinidad and Tobago. Those are your people that are not missing Raw. So it did rank among those countries specifically. But this is, you know, Bolivia is, you know, it is the crown jewel of the WWE map.
Yes. And number 6, you probably just said that, number 6 in the US. So it continues. I think there's only been 1 week here, you know, debut to date that is not ranked in the US.
NXT last Tuesday doing 618,000 viewers and a 0.09 in the demo. So this was pretty much a comparable viewership from the year prior, from the week prior, and dropping from a point, or up rather from a, no, down from a 0.10 the last week. So a small drop there. And do you have the Dynamite information from last Wednesday? I don't have it in front of me.
Excuse me.
Oh dear. Dynamite is you know, it is the show that sometimes is the hardest to track down at times, but we will
526,000. It's right here on the screen, right?
Yes, correct. There we go. So there you go. That was the Maximum Carnage edition of the show last week. Maximum Carnage, was this maximum viewership? Was that the
it was normal viewership in the Big Data Plus panel era, right? It was up slightly from the prior week. Much better than the New Year's Eve very low number. It's in the range of what Dynamite has been doing lately.
And finally, we had the Nielsen gauge for December of 2025. This was a big, big month for Netflix. Not only did it have Raw and SmackDown internationally, but it also had, it was benefited greatly by Stranger Things, which every single person seemed to watch every single season of Stranger Things.
Yes.
And then the P. Diddy documentary did it really well. And they had the NFL games on Christmas Day. So it was a pretty big month for Netflix viewership. But, you know, this is the real battle. It is Netflix versus YouTube. And what were the results in December?
Looks like 12.7% for YouTube. The big leader in streaming is our platform, our partners who, you know, we have a great relationship with. We haven't talked to the CEO ever, but we have a great relationship with YouTube. And Netflix at 9%.
Okay, well, and then there's everybody else. How's Paramount doing? Well, where is Paramount in the grand scheme?
2.5%. So it's doing better than Peacock.
Mm-hmm.
But this is Paramount. This is lumping in. What's their fast service? Pluto. This is Paramount and Pluto, and maybe I don't know if there's some other traces of other things here. But the new gauge is now combining all of the major media companies' multiple streaming platforms. So WBD is not just Max anymore; it's Max and Discovery Plus and whatever else. And Disney is now not just, it's because of course Hulu is kind of getting combined in and getting phased out. It's Disney Plus and Hulu and ESPN that's represented in the Disney data point of 4.7%.
Yeah. How fewer logos are we going to have on the right side of this gauge in the years to come?
Yeah. I don't know. What are they going to do? When WBD gets bought up, it's streaming gets bought up. Yeah, maybe it'll all be under Netflix, and the Netflix will be, it'll be 1.5% higher.
Yeah, and then there's poor Peacock. That, I mean, Olympics aside, I don't know. They're just gonna keep at it, I guess.
They'll sell to somebody eventually too.
That's kind of where the future of media is going. Everyone's gonna be bought by someone at some time. But there you go, everybody. That's your snapshot into December of 2025. And I feel that we are going to wrap up the show, but where would we be without a super chat from Jake from the Windy City? Do you think that there could be any independents ever considering going to Saudi Arabia next year for WrestleMania, or would the logistics make it nearly impossible?
We have a story on that from a few months ago.
That's right. Brett Lauderdale seems, he's ready. He's got his passport dusted off. He's open to it.
He said, wouldn't rule it out. And I think you contacted, or maybe we both did, Mike Buccicchio.
That's right.
Who oversees WrestleCon. And
basically said there was very little chance of that happening. I mean, that would be an undertaking that would not seem like a profitable one, to say the least.
Yes. So it sounds like at least WrestleCon's probably not going to do it, noting the higher expense of bringing talent over internationally, for one thing.
Ultimately, it would take a Saudi Arabian source that would want to sponsor your show and foot the bill to bring you over and give you as least resistance as possible to go over and just make money to go over there. And I just don't know what the interest is going to be for non-WWE events to be staged in Saudi Arabia.
Does Turkey want it? Maybe Turkey will make some phone calls and say, hey, we got a couple extra million laying around.
I mean, hey, Turkey Al Sheikh Spring Break. I'm sure the naming rights are up for grabs for the right price.
Yeah, maybe he'll make an appearance at Effie's show. Who knows?
Yeah, I don't. I'm not going to hold my breath for that one at all. To answer your question, Jake, I think it's probably going to be small. I won't say impossible that we might see some wrestling companies try. But I would think I'm more so curious to see if there is an attempt by AEW to try and stage some type of weekend in place of WrestleMania that becomes the destination for all of these companies to go and give fans a reason to have their WrestleMania weekend without WWE, which comes with its pluses and minuses. Like, you don't have the big leader to bring everyone to a city, but is there enough demand that all of these shows together could stage something in its absence?
Yeah, I think there's a huge branding opportunity here, right? With there'll be frustrated feelings from some fans that's going to Saudi Arabia, which is a far away. Secondly, it's in, you know, getting a huge payout from a government, directly from the government, to do so. And I think there's a great branding opportunity around this is the non-wrestling community, the non-WWE wrestling community, running shows and celebrating wrestling, and WWE tries to, set themselves apart from this community to some degree. I think it's a great alternative wrestling brand, opportunity to capture that market activity that WWE is probably not going to capture at that time.
Unified platform, more personalization, more customization.
They're getting paid very well to forego that.
All right, everyone, we're going to wrap things up, but thanks to everybody for joining us live. We are here every Wednesday, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. You can follow all of Brandon's work at WrestleNomics.com, Patreon.com/WrestleNomics, where you can keep up to date on all of his work and all of the latest TV figures, writing, research, doing all of the work, and always give credit to the original source, Brandon Thurston. Anything else going on in the pipeline for you, Brandon? Anything you want to tease us with?
I don't think so. Just as usual, there's TV ratings reports there. Should be getting a Raw one up very soon. I should do another set of charts for this big data dump from Netflix soon too.
Some wonderful graphs. If you were not watching on the YouTube version, do check them out. I think it'd be fun if we could compare me putting down all these stats into a Word document and then seeing Brandon's charts. I nearly sent these to you thinking I'd be helping you out. And then I thought felt wiser that I'm like, I'm sure Brandon is going to. And he did.
So you downloaded the Excel file.
Yes.
And then you made notes from the Excel file to a Word document.
Dude, I'm Word till I die. Okay, that's just how I operate. What you do, it's inspiring. I wish I had that level of.
It's not hard. I mean, doing basic things with Excel is not that hard.
Well, it's I'm basic. What can I say? That's going to end the show, everyone. Thanks for tuning in. I'm back tonight with Mr. Wei Ting. We will be live after Dynamite from Orlando. And we're doing a special Tanahashi Okada retrospective Thursday on Rewind Away. We're going to talk about some of their famous matches together. So that's coming your way at postwrestlingcafe.com. Until then, stay frothy.
Yeah, this episode was dedicated to Sean McDermott, by the way.
Gone and forgotten. Like the Bills, unfortunately. This month at postwrestlingcafe.com, go XL and you get live editions of Rewind to Raw, Rewind to Dynamite, and Rewind to SmackDown, featuring all the news of the day, your questions and answers, as well as feedback. Postwrestlingcafe.com, $6 gets you in the door.